Beloved MTV VJ, music exec, and radio personality Matt Pinfield has spent almost four decades in front of and behind the mic. He signed bands, interviewed Beatles, and had songs written about him. But now, he's having a different conversation. He's talking with friends and supporters across the entertainment industry about their journey and how he's found his voice again, being open about his recovery. This is Sound, Sobriety, and Success.
Hey everyone, welcome to Matt Pinfield's Sound, Sobriety, and Success. Today I'm excited and honored to have this incredible singer, songwriter, producer, an amazing woman. I've been a big fan of hers from the very first time I heard her music, and we've become great friends over the years, and I'm so honored to have her on the show today. And I'm talking about Linda Perry. Linda, good to see you. How you doing?
Hi, Matt. It's been a while. Thank you. That was such a sweet introduction.
Well, you know, Linda, it's amazing because when I first discovered, you know, Four Non Blondes on the record, I was really early on one of the first radio programmers. I was programming radio then as a program director, music director. I immediately fell in love with the record and added the record and just started banging it in promotion and doing promotion for, you know, just like literally. And it's sort of one of the groundswells for that album started in Jersey, New York, where I was. And, you know, I really believed in it. And there were some programmers that were not on board. And, you know, and the label would have me call them up and go, dude, would you call these people and tell them what's going on and how it's reacting in your market? And I would do that and go, hey, you know, and so people, you know, there was definitely some people I was able to nudge. And then they just had to get out of the way because it became a huge hit. So we proved them wrong and that we were right. You know what I mean? So, and then ever since then, we've had a long relationship.
Yeah. No, you know, I think that sometimes in these days, people don't realize there was a whole other art to breaking artists and songs and albums. And, you know, and I just did this thing at Live at the Vineyards in Napa Valley where it was all radio programmers. And I just went out there just to kind of show support because, listen, I still believe in radio. I do. I believe in this frequency. The podcast, the radio, all that, because it's really nice that there's somebody at the other end. And so what I told all these radio programmers from stage, I said, listen, the day you guys start trying to compete with Spotify and iTunes and all the DSPs, that's the day you guys will just bury yourselves. And radio was a very prominent thing for my band. And yes, you were one of the first that were out there pushing it. And my Interscope was ready to drop us, you know, because we didn't have... People were saying, like, is this a girl? Is this a guy? Is this a rock band? Is this a folk band? People didn't know what it was because it didn't sound like anything. And I'm a little weirdo, you know, I like dreadlocks and wearing shorts and big hats. And, you know, like, you know, I have no fucking idea what that band was, but it was fun. And a lot of people didn't take us serious. And so I do appreciate that. And that's why I've always been super respectful. You have an incredible ear because you are a music-driven human being. You know, like everything you do has music in mind, like how to support it. And I think that's very rare right now that you're still actually doing that in a world where people don't really fucking give a shit, you know, what radio people say or all that stuff. Anyway, so... I'm still fighting a good fight out there trying to get new artists to understand about going into the radio, playing for them, play these shows, because that's where I think we're going to get a little bit more longevity with artists.
I agree. You know, it's funny you said Live at the Vineyard, because the year before, Chrissy, those guys had brought me up and I'd done some introductions of bands. And, you know, there's many different formats, you know, like in radio, there's AAA, there's hot AC, there's alternative, there's rock. And you know me, I've kind of been across the board. I've never really been able to be nailed into just one format because I'm a lover of all things music. It's just, is it a great song? Is the artist genuine? Is there something that has an emotional connection? And I think that that's the thing that is so important, no matter how, a song registers with you, right? Like if it's something that you enjoy because of the melody or something you can sing along with, or it's deeper than that. If you're getting into the lyric or the way that it makes you feel. So I love that, you know, and I feel very lucky and blessed, A, that I'm still working in this business, you know, after 40 years, and that also that I've never lost that passion or that feeling and love for it that I had when I was a young kid. And, you know, they say music chooses you or you choose it. It depends on which, when that is, but I definitely, that was the first thing that I really responded to as a young child. So I'm very grateful for that. And speaking of that, like, talk to me about, you and I are, you know, we're really close in age. So you were born in Springfield, Massachusetts, right? So what are some of your earliest memories of music for you? Can you remember the first time you were attracted to music?
Yeah. So I was literally born there, but 1 year old, we moved to California. My father was an engineer for the government, and there, you know, San Diego's where we ended up going. And I was raised in San Diego. Boston, I didn't even really know. I was too young. So being raised in San Diego, my mother's Brazilian. My father loved Frank Sinatra and Cole Porter and Dean Martin and stuff like that. He liked jazz. My mom listened to Sergio Mendes, Gilberto, Brazilian music. Carmen Miranda, she loved. So she had, everything was Brazilian for her, Latin. My father, everything was jazz or, you know, the Brat Pack. And my sister was into Elvis and the Beach Boys, and my brothers were listening to more, you know, like the harder stuff, like harder back then, meaning the Beatles, Stones, the Turtles, the Monkees, and me, like, so that's all around me as I'm taking in all this information. And so it's 1965. And then I discovered on my own, I loved musicals. Like, I loved The Jungle Book. I loved Chitty Chitty Bang Bang because I loved the songs in there. You know, to me, the Trust in Me song that the snake sings is just so great. And then my biggest push was Karen Carpenter. Now, the interesting thing about the Carpenters is, it helped me really dive into music and what it's supposed to do. Now, when I'm singing the musicals and Sound of Music and all this stuff, I'm only having this fun reaction. But then when I heard, I believe it was Close to You. Now, we're talking about a woman who's singing about birds in the sky and all that stuff, right? I mean, it gets pretty cheesy there. But there was something about her voice that just sunk deep in me. Like, it was like, because I had a very troubling, hard, you know, childhood. And so I instantly gravitated towards her voice because I wasn't really listening to what she was singing. I was listening to how she was singing it. And it was dark, you know, like, why do birds, you know, like, it just, she had this dark, breathy, resonated voice that just didn't sound like anybody. And so that was my big moment where I started going down the rabbit hole of music.
Yeah, I mean, you know, you look at some of those songs and Rainy Days and Mondays, which is such an incredible track. Yeah. Now you get older, you listen to those lyrics, right? And so, and you hear her delivery, the melancholy.
Oh, yeah. Like, you know, the superstar, you know.
My favorites.
Yeah, I mean, just so dark.
Russell wrote that, you know, like Leon Russell wrote that. I love that song. It's to me, it'll be a Carpenter song forever. It's just an incredible track. I think Kim Gordon covered it once from Sonic Youth as well.
Yeah, Sonic Youth covered it, and they did a really cool, actually Thurston sang it. But, you know, I think that for me, and then I started looking for that sound because it was like, I felt like, oh, here's somebody who relates to my, because she sounded dark to me. Now, mind you, I don't know what that means back then. I'm just listening to this, you know, singer that has a lot of emotion and it's dark and it doesn't sound like anything. And then my big fucking blow my mind was when I heard it on the TV and I ran to the TV and I was trying to find her and I heard the voice, But I see the bass player, I see the guitar player, I see the piano player, I see the drummer, I see all this. And then they go on a close up and she's fucking on the drums. And I was like, holy shit, what the fuck is that? You know? And I just remember it being like, I just got goosebumps again. I remember getting goosebumps watching this woman like on the fucking drum singing the song. It was like incredible. And then I found her story fascinating after that. Then I just kind of started trying to look up what was going on, you know?
Yeah. I mean, it's amazing that she was actually, if you see clips of her playing, I think even before like 1970, when they actually got signed and did that Burt Bacharach, Hal David song, close to you, their first major hit. She was a badass drummer, too.
She's a great jazz drummer, incredible drummer. And one of the things that, you know, and then I did a deep dive is, you know, throughout my years, I've been fascinated with her. And so I've read a lot. I've talked to her brother. I've talked to other people. I mean, I went in deep and, you know, he doesn't want anything to do with anything about what happened to her because in a weird way, he's kind of responsible. He has to be somewhat responsible because basically Karen Carpenter got taken away from her drums. That's what was her safe place. She knew she was good at that. And then they took her, put her in dresses and put her in front. Like she wore sweatpants and jeans and sweatshirts and she wasn't the typical beauty. And then they started putting makeup on her and making her dress this way and getting her off of the drums, putting her in the forefront, telling her that she's not typically the standard beauty that would be in front leading a band. And she developed a very, very toxic relationship with that by becoming anorexic and having a lot of anxiety, turning to pills to help that. And just, you know, and then, I mean, and she died. Karen Carpenter died because she was severely uncomfortable with being in the front and she was forced to do that. And she, there was a thing where she said, I gladly step aside, you know, but she felt a loyalty and a responsibility and no one helped her. They pretended wasn't happening until she was in the hospital.
I feel it's really so sad because people like Karen, and even if you look back at the Elvis thing, I think that, you know, they went through things publicly and privately that people didn't really understand or know about at that time. And there are people trying to keep the train rolling. You know what I mean? Like literally because it was a business, their biggest concern was to keep that on track. So they didn't really take a look at the human being themselves. And sometimes, you know, in Elvis's case, being surrounded by yes men and yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
Well, that, you know, though, after all those years, you know, I'm working with this organization called Cure Addiction Now. And it's this woman, Nancy Davis, her son, Jason Davis, OD'd. She has another son, Brandon Davis. So she's been doing a lot of work around how to help people, you know, because as we know, the organizations of like going into a rehab, it doesn't always work, you know.
Oh, no, I know.
You know what I mean? And most of the time, it doesn't work. So I'm working this woman to, you know, the organization to help them. It's like there was addictions when Billie Holiday.
Yeah.
Up to Demi Lovato. It's been going on for decades and decades and decades, and it's still a problem. Maybe there's more awareness and eyes on it right now, but it's still a problem. There's still people hiding it and dying left and right from addiction because they can't fix the demon. There's a demon in there, and it's telling you all sorts of crazy shit. And sometimes you get weak and you listen to it, and you can't take it anymore. And sometimes the only option seems like, you know, I'm out.
Yeah, because I think sometimes people get to a point where like, I can't continue to live this way, but I can't live without it. And and it's a very desperate place to be. And I think we've all felt that feeling at some time. I know that I definitely felt like that in the past.
You know what I'm saying? I'm lucky because, listen, I've done every drug you can think of, you know, and I'm sure you have done. I've done it all.
Yes.
And yes. I just one day was like, I go through spurts. Like one day, I mean, I had a 3-month heroin binge and then I came home one day and threw it all away and I just moved on. And then I became a cokehead for like another 4 months. And then I, you know, was dropping acid prior to that. I've been on crystal. I've been an alcoholic. I've been all these things. But as soon as I'm just like done, I'm like, okay. So at 40, one day I just woke up. I stopped smoking. I stopped drinking. I stopped drinking coffee and I became a vegan, like all in one shot. And I've never had a puff, never had a drink, you know, and I haven't eaten meat since. And I'm lucky to have that type of personality where once I say no, because one of the things, and this is not to judge, but it's very much similar to people that can't lose weight without doing the shortcuts. Ozempic, whatever it's called, this, diet plans, all these things, they want to be able to stop eating, but they don't want to make the life change because you're like right now, you see all these reports on the Ozempic, whatever, people are losing weight, they get off of it, and they just gain the weight all back. There's nothing different because they're not making the life change. We have to make life changes, not just, okay, this will fix me for right now.
Because there is no shortcut. It's like, that's the truth is it's all about lifestyle. It's changing your actual lifestyle.
Yeah.
And it's finding a way, whether that is through 12-step programs, whether that is whatever it is that helps you get through that. I mean, you have to be completely, you have to be all in, right? I mean, that's the thing. There's no other way. People have been trying to get through with shortcuts for a really long time. And, you know, I believe there's not just one way to stay sober or get off drugs or lose weight or any other kind of addiction that you might have. There's not just one way. I mean, I know what's worked for me, but I think it's really important to realize that you have to be all in, you know, and you have to work hard. And sometimes you're going to fall and trip, but that's all right. It's about getting back up again.
Well, also just to end this particular area, I think that is important to understand too, that addiction is taking on, should I say, there's a lot of different types of addiction in the world today that are killing people. There's people who are addicted to selfieing, they're falling off cliffs. There's people who are addicted to their cell phone or their texting and crashing and killing people because they're driving and texting. There's so many things going on right now. And you have to wonder, like, where does it all, like, there's got to be something that's stemming. It's all coming from some kind of point in the brain or in the body that we get addicted to these patterns. And then we don't want to break it no matter what. You know, there are tons of people right now, you know, that are like driving and they know if they pick up their phone, that's wrong. But you're just driving. It's like, well, there's no traffic. And then they can't help it. The phone is calling to them to text.
And that's what happened to me. I mean, you know the story. I was hit by a car, like, because for that exact reason, nearly killed, nearly crippled. Gratefully, I'm here. But that was the root of that experience, you know? So you're absolutely right about it. Yeah, the story about people taking selfies and getting in very dangerous situations, it's all so crazy. But I wanted to say and talk about this because, you know, I love your career. And for me, what's really interesting is, and I so relate to, is that you cared about and loved music so much. You had that adventurous spirit and you decided, like, I'm going to move to San Francisco. So when you did, you know, you lived in a windowless room, right? You were doing whatever it took, which meant, you know, doing jobs of waitressing or, you know, waiting tables. It could have been really anything. But tell me about that experience, about when you decided, like, listen, music is my passion. It's what I want to do with myself. And this is whatever it takes. I'm going to do the work. So 21, you moved to San Francisco. Take me through that.
Yeah. So When I was in San Diego, I started writing songs, and they were very like Everything But the Girl, like very like, you know, like kind of had this very folky, jazzy kind of thing. Sade.
Tracy Thorn, man, that stuff.
Great fucking band. And her voice is so cool. But so Tracy Thorn, Sade, I really liked. I liked their voices. And so I started writing songs in that genre. And then I literally had $7 in my pocket. I was squatting, you know, on someone's couch. And this girl comes, and a friend of the girl that I was staying with, she's like, hey, I got to go to San Francisco. It's going to be 1987, you know, this, you know, weekend and New Year. Asking Sue, do you want to go? Sue's like, I'm working, dude. I work at a bar. I can't leave, you know? And she looks at me and she's like, what about you? I don't want to drive by myself. And I'm like, well, sure. I go, I just want to let you know I don't have any money. I don't know how to get home. She's like, I'll fly you home. I'll take care of you for the weekend. I'm like, okay, great. So we go to San Francisco, and I'm literally getting there going, holy shit, you know, I'm supposed to be here. And then I started just kind of writing more songs, and this huge voice came out. I felt free. I felt alive. I felt heard. I felt like I was where I was supposed to be. And then I just started playing to people in my flat, you know, and where I had roommates. And then it turned into me going to the Night Break, the I-Beam, all these places, the Stone, just to, hey, my name's Linda Perry, and I can play if you need me to. And they would be like going, and what do you do? And I'm like, I just play acoustic, and I can get up on stage. I'm really easy. If you ever need someone easy, I'm the person to call, and I would just leave my number. And then finally, one day, this guy, Mark, from the Night Break, you could hear his voice being so reluctant, but he was like, hey, is this Linda Perry? And I'm like, yeah. He's like, this is Mark from the Night Break. The band that I had opening just canceled, and I need somebody tonight. And I'm literally, I don't even put the phone down. I'm just, you know, right there at the Night Break. And so I performed, and I got a write-up in the San Francisco Weekly about this girl that just got up on stage. Anyways, so I just waited tables. I made matchbooks to sell them. I did whatever I could. I was flyering all over San Francisco. Started playing shows, opened up for X, opened up for Romeo Void, opened up for Bob Mole, Sam Phillips. I started getting a thing happening. And then this band showed up, and that's basically how that started. But I was so dedicated because, listen, I didn't have an option B. All I knew was I'm going to be a rock star. I had the personality for it. I had the drive for it. I had the charm. I was charming. I charmed my way into a lot of places. And when I was on stage, I was a fucking powerhouse. You know, I was there on my own with the guitar, and I was fucking slamming people down on the ground. And they couldn't believe the power that was coming out of this little, I mean, I'm small. I'm a small person, and they couldn't believe it, you know? So that's kind of where it all started.
It's amazing because I love that. It's you had that I don't give a fuck attitude, and like, this is who I am, and I believe in me and what I'm doing. So, which is incredible. So talk to me about the time that you and Stephen Jenkins ended up working on songs together in a room. And you guys, tell me a bit about that.
Well, it wasn't, okay, so what it was Vanessa, his girlfriend at the time, and I were working on music, and he was coming in and ruining everything, you know, and listen, I'm sure he's a sweet guy, rubs me the wrong way. He treated her like
he had something, a thing called Puck and Taddy instead of Tuck and Patty.
Oh yeah. I don't know. I met him afterwards, after I came to Los, I met him once.
Yeah.
And then he was telling me.
So that's a misguided story.
That's a misguided story. I worked with his girlfriend, and Vanessa and I were working on a really cool album, and he was not very kind to her and was very disruptive. And I did not like his presence in my studio. He, you know, whatever. I try not to say bad things to people, but that's an energy that I choose not to be around. So yeah, him and I never worked together.
I'm glad you cleared that up.
He tried. Should I say he was trying?
Well, I'm glad you cleared that up for me because, you know, I know that's the thing I love about you is you're always straight up and up front, and ever since we've known each other, which is great. Now, one of my things that I really wanted to talk to you about, I love that you did when you were doing, you know, the tributes to the Who and the stuff with Roger Daltrey, you're working. And I thought it was so cool that you do Acid Queen or songs like that, because I always thought about Tina Turner's, you know, performance in the film of Acid Queen. Powerful it was.
Oh, good.
Now it was that, I mean, that's the thing I took away from that movie as one of the most incredible moments, terrifying and beautiful and just strong and dark, right? So all these things that are really cool. And I said, wow, when I found out you did that, I was like, wow, she's perfect for that, because you've got that quality where you can deliver vocally with that kind of strength. Tell me about how that whole thing went down, because you did quite a few great Who songs.
Yeah, so that was like literally the highlight of a very pivotal point in my career. I was getting confused with Four Non Blondes because I didn't feel like, one, we were being taken serious. Two, I hated the album. Three, I always just wanted to jam and go off and just dick around on stage when we performed. But the band was so like metronomy in every little moment. And they were getting very jealous that people wanted to talk to me. And I said, listen, guys, you guys are boring. You don't go out and do anything. Fucking step up to the plate. I don't want it. Like, I hate it. I hate being fucking talked to. I hate photos and I hated all that. And I'm like, but I'm trying to do it for the band, because we're going to get in trouble if somebody doesn't step up. And you guys are fucking just laying low doing jack shit. So I hear. Here, please take on the responsibility. Anyway, so there was a lot of friction, and we were working on the second record, and it was like, it was going to be a hit. The record was going to be a hit, but it was a hit of stuff that I didn't want to be a part of. I wanted to make Dark Side of the Moon, and everybody wanted to make Bigger, Better, Faster, More Part 2, you know, and I just wasn't in that headspace. So my best friend and I have 38 years right now. So back then we were talking, and Aubin, his name is Aubin, and he's like, well, what do you want to do? And I said, bud, I want to play Carnegie Hall. I want an awesome band. I want 55 piece orchestra. I want people sitting down in nice clothes and listening and watching me. I want them to hear me. You know, because all the shows we were playing were just kids moshing back and forth, and it never felt good to me, right? So anyway, so then my manager calls me, and she's like, you know, someone's going to call you. Believe that it's Who it is, you know, because she knew I was a big fucking Who fan. And so this person calls me with this English accent, and I'm like going, what the fuck? And he's like, hey, it's Roger Daltrey, you know, whatever. And I'm like going, fucking no way. And he's like, your manager said you were going to say that, you know, whatever. He's like, listen, it's my birthday, and I'm going to play Carnegie Hall with Michael Kamen conducting a 55-piece orchestra. Bob Ezrin, my favorite producer. I wanted him for our record, but was like not available. Bob Ezrin producing, Michael Kamen conducting, The Who is playing, minus, you know, Keith. And we have Sinead O'Connor, Eddie Vedder. But you remind me a good friend of mine back in the day, Janis Joplin. And I think you're incredible. And I would love for you to come and sing Dr. Jimmy and Acid Queen with me. Or not with him, but just sing those songs. And I was like still on Carnegie Hall, Michael Kamen, and the fucking Who, right?
Right.
And I'm like going, yes, yes, a fucking course, yes, right? And so, great. So I learned, you know, Dr. Jimmy was a hard one. I already knew Acid Queen, but Dr. Jimmy, that's a tricky fucking tune, right?
So yeah, it's a great song, and it's also very aggressive. It's got a very different perspective.
Yeah, I mean, it was awesome.
Yeah.
So I get there, I go to New York, I get there, I walk into the rehearsal, I see fucking Pete Townsend, John Entwistle, Roger Daltrey just standing there talking. Michael is on his little conducting, And I just started crying. I couldn't fucking believe it. I couldn't believe it. I had just said this. This is what I wanted to do, right? So Roger comes up to me and puts his arm around me. He's like, are you okay? And I'm like, dude, I am so fucking okay. And then he threw in, you know, I'm free. He's like, hey, during rehearsal, he's like, will you sing I'm Free with me? And I'm like, yeah. You know, so it was like mind blowing. And then Terry Gilliam, one of my favorite directors that I was trying to get to do a Four Non Fucking Blonde video for, he was in the audience. And then after I do my my thing, he comes out, he finds me. Now, Terry Gilliam is coming to fucking find me. Brazil, Terry Gilliam, you know, Time Bandits, that guy comes to find me. And he's like looking at me and he's like, you are an interesting character. Did someone tell you to look like this and dress like this and make those faces? And I'm like, no, that's just how I sing and relate to music. And he's like, you're fascinating to watch, you know? And I mean, I guess he's like, you remind me of one of my characters in one of my films. So anyways, that's how that happened. And I went home, I shaved all my dreads off. And I said, I'm going to change fucking everything right now. And I did.
It's amazing. And then, you know, just I would love to hear that version of Dr. Jimmy. Quadrophenia is one of my favorite albums. I mean, I love all those records. The Who, I mean, I understand how you felt. I remember, you know, the first time I met Pete Townsend and he came into a booth at South by Southwest for a TV broadcast. And he said, Penfield, I've heard all about you. The fact that he knew who I was blew me away. And then he's sitting next to me. He's talking to me about new music in my ear. And I've interviewed a lot of people, as you know, Linda, right? And, you know, whether it's the Stones or McCartney and then down the line. But there was a moment where I went, that's Pete Townsend talking in my ear, man. That's Pete. That's how much I love The Who. You know what I mean?
Yeah, so, no, I agree. But Keith Moon was one of my favorite drummers and still is. You know, I just, his crazy, wild, you know, way. But, you know, I had that experience with Pete during the show. And he's sitting there and he's watching Roger and he's like, looks at me and he's like, if it were my 50th birthday, you know where I'd be? I'd be in bed watching TV and relax. This guy wants to fucking go and put on this massive show on his 50th birthday. And he's like, and he still doesn't get it that I don't like the way he sings my songs.
Which is hilarious because he's... Roger's one of the greatest vocalists ever.
I know.
And performance as a frontman. He's one of the greatest frontmen ever.
And sexy and a rock god. I mean,
yeah,
he so had it all. Incredible.
Yeah. And he's a really nice man. I mean, yeah, obviously, you know that.
So
but,
nice.
But I mean, that was a great surprise. And not really a surprise, but it was just so, so lovely that he was such a good, kind person.
Yeah, totally.
So tell me about the changes. You were always a songwriter. When did you realize it was going to be that time where you were going to be able to start writing songs for other people? And what was the catalyst for that? Because you've written so many great songs. You're in the Songwriters Hall of Fame. What was that moment?
I didn't really, honestly, I didn't have a moment. I was like, I just knew I didn't want to be in that band anymore. I knew that. So I just made that change. I did it in shifts. So you're not happy, get out of the band. So I went to Tom Wally, said, I need out of this band. He's like, I can't do that, but I can get rid of everybody else. I'm like, no, don't do that. And then he ended up doing it without telling me. So I just knew that it was, you know, I'm writing songs. When I write for me, I'm like, I'm dark. I'm a dark person. And there's only so much darkness one can handle, you know? And so I left the band and then I had an argument with myself in my car driving to LA because I lived in San Francisco and I started recording bands in San Francisco. All I knew is I wasn't going to let anybody do that sound to a record. I literally cringe when I hear the Four Non Blonde record. It's so ear-piercingly bad to me. The sonic, the whole structure of it, the way it sounds, it's unbearable. So I started buying a bunch of gear in San Francisco and just started hooking it up, learning how to do it myself. I put a stage in my house and I started recording bands there, you know? And so I got a lot of education. And then I moved from San Francisco to LA because my gut feeling said, come to LA. And so I did. I did make a beautiful record called In Flight with Bill Bottrell that was just, I don't give a fuck if anybody heard it or not. It's a beautiful record that I'm so proud of.
He's a great producer.
Interscope shelved it because I refused to call it Four Non Blondes. And so Jimmy shelved it to teach me a lesson. So I was like, fine, whatever. It doesn't take away how great the record is. Fuck you, you know? But that was a good sign for me to exit now. And so then I was so analog and always like really snobby about like how you recorded. Like if you weren't using a U47 and a Neve and all that stuff, you weren't really recording. Like I had that like a born again Christian, you know, like how annoying you can be as a born again Christian trying to preach the gospel, how analog is better than anything ever. So I got out of that phase and I'm like, okay, listen, Linda, you're going to go listen to what that fucking sound is that's really annoying on the radio in 2000, right? And I'm listening. I'm like, so I start asking friends. I'm like, what is that? What is this? Oh, that's a Trident through the Roland, you know, expansion card. And people are using now D88s, you know, blah, 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 blah. And I went and bought all that shit and I hooked it all up. And I'm like, okay, I'm going to write the stupidest song I can imagine, but not really writing. I'm just going to try to emulate what's going on. And then I wrote Get the Party Started. And it was literally a joke of me just trying to figure out what this shit did, you know? And then about a week after that, this girl calls me, named Pink, cold calls me, leaves a crazy message. And I met with her. I said, you know, I'm not hip. You know, and she's like, are you the Linda Perry that sang Dear Mr. President and was in Four Non Blondes? I'm like, yeah. She's like, yes, you are. You're hip enough for me because I love you anyways. So then I played her the song. She played it to L.A. Reid. And that's basically how Linda Perry, the songwriter, showed up.
That's amazing. I love that story. You know, I have two daughters, both very strong personalities and individuals. And my youngest, the first song that she ever sang, and that's my memory of her at 3 years old, was Beautiful. So, and I always loved the message of the song, and that will always stay with me. And so I want to talk about that song because it's such an incredible song. And I know somebody inside of RCA at the time told me they felt that Christina's Dirty track, Christina Aguilera's first single from that second record, was a mid-charter. And they were kind of like, oh, what are we going to do next? And well, one of my friends there, Lou Robinson, who'd worked there at the time, he went in and said, guys, you have to put out Beautiful second because that's the song that's on this record. It's a hit. You can't go for another track and risk, you know, you got to go right for this song. I'm telling you. And he was right. He was absolutely right. Can you tell me about that song? Because there's so much about the message too, about being accepting you for who you are, realizing that you're beautiful. And it's an empowering song for a girl, for a woman, for a male, for anybody, really. Yeah, because, sure. I mean, the message is universal in that way, to learn how to accept yourself and see the beauty in yourself. Talk to me about that for you. And
well, that song was like more like when I started writing it and I got to that chorus, like, you are beautiful, I like put on the brakes. I was like, what? No, I can't sing that because I don't believe that. You know, I feel like I'm a quirky looking person that, you know, beauty is not what you see when you see Linda Perry. You know what I mean? So when that line came, because I just ad lib, I don't write lyrics. They just show up. So when I did that chorus and I started singing, I am beautiful no matter what you say, that I just was like, oh, no, I can't sing that. But then I had to listen to my own advice that I give a lot of people. Don't stop the process of a song. Just keep writing it, you know? No matter if you think it's a good or bad song or it's weird, just finish the song that you started. So then after I was done with it, I realized, oh, It's someone who's trying to find their beauty. And it's someone who's trying to remind people that beauty isn't just your physical, you know, it's in, there's so much beauty in so many things that we do on a daily basis. So I had this nugget of a song that I thought was just a really great song. I don't look at things as a hit. In my story, you'll understand that my whole career is based on instinct. I don't think I've ever planned one fucking thing. I think it's all just been me going on my gut, on my instinct. And so one night I went out, which I never do. And at this club, I see Christina Aguilera sitting there all by herself with the bodyguard and behind the red rope, you know, in this whole section. She's all by herself. So I walked up to there and her and I had met one time. And I don't think Pink's record was out yet. I don't think Misunderstood was out yet. So she tells the bodyguard, yeah, let her in. And so I go in. I'm like, hey, how you doing? She's like, good. And I said, hey, I heard you were working on an album. And I just wanted to say, you have so much darkness and you have so much insecurity. And I hope you use that for this next album, because it would really be incredible to hear that come from you, because we all know you can sing, but I think people struggle with trying to understand if you actually feel what you're singing. And she was just like, you know, looking at me like with this horrified look. And I'm like, I got to go, but it was really nice seeing you. Good luck with your album. I wasn't even pitching me. I was just telling her something that I was supposed to tell her, apparently. So I told her that, and then I walked away, and then literally I'm thinking, oh, that girl's never going to call me for anything. A week later, her people reach out and say Christina wants to work with Linda. So I had written Beautiful, you know, recently. And so when she showed up at my studio, I had a strict policy of no managers, no posse, no friends. It's just me and you. You know,
that's the greatest thing ever. Knowing that, I love that.
Yeah. So she shows up and she's like kind of walking around my studio and she's like, can you play me something to ease the ice or break the ice? And I like your voice and that would help me. And I'm like, all right. So I sit down. I'm like, okay, I just wrote this song. It's fresh on my head. And I play her Beautiful. And after I was done, she looked at me and she's like, can you demo that for me and give me the lyrics? And I'm like, why? She's like, because I want it on my album. And I'm like, what? This song doesn't apply to you. This applies to ugly people. You know what I mean? And I'm not clear yet, Matt. I'm not clear what the song is yet. And Christine is a little hottie. You know what I mean? She's like a, you know, popular hot chick that's out on the prowl out there in the world and, you know, all that. Like, she did not resemble what to me the song was about. So I was like, okay, well, I'll let her sing it and see what happens. So she comes to my studio again. She asks, can I bring somebody? And I'm like, you can bring one person. She brings this person. I demo the piano, give her the lyrics, put the mic in front of her. Song starts. She looks at her friend, says, don't look at me, you know, and that whispery, like, don't look at me. Right there, I knew, holy shit, this girl is insecure. She's not all that confident. She is. And then she starts singing the song and I got shivers and I'm like, oh yeah, this song is for her, because she doesn't really actually think she's beautiful. She's insecure. She had all the pieces, all the little ingredients to make for what exactly the song was about. And then the song hit me like, oh yeah, this song is about people like her that are good looking, but don't believe that they're beautiful inside.
Yeah, that's incredible. What a great story. And
yeah, and she nailed it. And that was her demo vocal. And then we went and did a couple little punch-ins later on down the line, but that was, that scratch vocal was the end vocal.
You know, I've got to ask you too, like, I mean, you've, you know, worked for and written with or for a bunch of different people and a lot of across the spectrum, because, you know, we talk about the different things that you love. You love rock that's, you know, got that kind of chaotic edge, the great Who stuff that you've loved. But you know, you've worked for written with like Jewel, Courtney Love, Gwen Stefani, Alicia Keys, which when I hear that, when you talked about Everything But the Girl and Tracy Thorn, I thought, yeah, so it makes sense. There's so many different things that you love. Is there anyone in particular artist that you'd work with that you just had the greatest time spending time with, not just collaborating with, but you just love the hang, you know what I mean? Whether that be Cheap Trick or...
I mean, I was just listening to the song I did for Cheap Trick, to be honest. I know they're working on another album and I want to get another song on that album because I've gotten two songs. But now listen, Cheap Trick was like, it didn't get any higher for me in my youth. Surrender, Live at Budokan, I Want You to Want Me. They're nothing. Like, that is the fucking jump on the fucking bed, air guitar fucking band, right? Dream Police, all of it. I mean, those fucking guys were amazing. They wrote some of the greatest fucking songs, and in and their production and the way they did, they were fucking cool. They are still cool. Anyways, so I was thinking about that. So I put on, I'm like, oh yeah, I want to remember that song. So I get this call, Cheap Trick wants to work with me, and I froze. I'm like going, oh, no, if I don't write a song better than Surrender, there's no point of doing this. Like, I can't. So, I mean, I put the expectations were fucking high. And so I get to my studio and I just see all of Rick's guitars lying down my fucking hallway. And I'm like going, now I'm shivering. I'm sweating. I'm like, what the fuck am I doing? I'm not ready for this. I'm not. I just started. I'm a baby in this business, you know, a producer. And like, I was just started. I didn't have a lot on my fucking my resume as a producer, you know? So I dial in sounds. I'm like doing my stuff. I have this idea of the song, you know, and I never prepare. I never write a song before an artist comes in, ever. But in this particular day, I fucking did. Like right before they showed up, I wrote this whole song called Perfect Stranger. And they walk in and I just want something to present them because, you know, we're going to work on it. We might work on some other stuff. That's in my mind is what's going to happen. And those guys walk in and I'm like going, holy fuck. They're like, so do you got anything for us? I'm like, I have this, you know, idea of a song. It's called Perfect Stranger. I play it to them and they're like, great. You know, okay, let's take it down a whole step. No, you know what, Robin's all, take it down a step and a half. I feel like it'll sit better in there. They work it out. We're talking about this all happened within like 30 fucking minutes, right? And I'm like, wait, no, I'm not ready. That's not better than Surrender. They're like, Linda, this is a great fucking song and we're going to record it right now. And I'm like, but it... You guys, I'm not even dialed in yet. And, you know, Bunny comes, sits on the drums. He rat-a-tat-tats for a couple seconds. And I'm trying to, you know, I'm moving as fast as I fucking can, right? And so they run it one time with stops and whatever. And then they run it again. I'm recording. Thank God I'm recording fucking everything, Matt. So I'm recording. And then Bunny just gets up and leaves. And I'm like, where did he go? And they're like, oh, he only does one take. And I'm like, was that a take? I'm like, wait a minute, was that a fucking take? You know, and Rick started laughing. And then they just started laughing, going, yeah, kid, you know, that's the way it rolls with us. And then we just sat and we talked. And Rick and Robin and Tom, I had the greatest time. It was like I learned so much hanging with them. And you know what? I listened to that song and the production, but it's a fucking good song, you know? And so I can say that was a big highlight for me because that was my hero band that walked into my room and fucking turned my life upside down and made my hair fall out and made me work so hard, so fast. It was the greatest experience I ever had.
That's incredible. And so they're working on a new record, this 50th anniversary. So you're going to maybe collaborate again or?
Oh, well, I kind of just send them songs, you know, and then so on the last record, I sent them a song called Here's Looking at You. And it's a really good song if you haven't heard it off their last album. But I just sent that to them. I'm like, hey, I was thinking about you guys and I wrote this. Here you go. And then I didn't even know that they recorded the song until the album came out and I saw it out. And I'm like, holy shit. And then Rick Nielsen emails me every year since I met them. And I don't even know what year that was, for my birthday every year, and sends me a happy birthday. I mean, the nicest fucking guy. And so, yeah, I heard that they're working on a new album. I know their manager, and I'm like, I'm fucking writing a song for you guys. And I just saw Tom at this Dolly Parton record release, and he was like, yeah, I can't wait. You know, you write us the best songs. I'm like, awesome.
I think that's great. I mean, I'm such a huge Cheap Trick fan since I was a kid. So, and that, you know, it's funny you said that too, because Rick is that kind of guy. Like, he used to write to the English magazines because he used to get subscriptions when kids couldn't really get them in the 70s. And late 60s. And he told me about a letter he wrote to Roy Wood of the band The Move. Of course, you know, Jeff Lynne was in the later version of that band and then turned into ELO. But he told me about it once, and then he emailed me and sent me the article that where they responded to him, where he was like, you know, like 17, 16 years old. I love him for that. So I wanted to just tell you that, because that's the kind of guy. He's like a music fan, a music fanatic who loves music so much from the bottom of his heart. Like you and I do. So I think it's, and that means the world to you. And speaking of the Dolly Parton thing and Danny, their manager, and everybody, I want to talk to you about having Dolly Parton do Four Non Blondes, and it became a number one record. But what was the experience? You'd worked with her before, right?
I worked with her on this album for the Dumplin' movie on Netflix. And we wrote 6 songs in 3 days, and I re-recorded 6 of her classics.
And you had fun with that, right? I mean, because she's
so much fun. I mean, Dolly, there is no frequency as high as hers.
Yeah, she's amazing. And I'm so happy this album was successful. How was the experience for you, knowing everything that we just talked about with the history of what's up, and as some people erroneously call it, what's going on, and getting to record that with her and kind of guiding her, directing her through that? What was that experience like?
I didn't guide anything from her. She recorded the song and then sent it to me and said, can you sing on here and play acoustic? And I'm like, I didn't even know that she was recording a song.
Wow. So that's what happened.
And I'm like, God. And so I was talking to Danny and he started laughing. I'm like, well, good thing. I love you guys, you know. But she did an amazing, Dolly, you don't have to really tell Dolly. Dolly does her thing. And so she went off and she didn't even tell Danny she was making this record. She just put songs together that she liked. She started putting it together. She had her team, and she fucking made a fucking double album of some of the hardest fucking songs that people won't even touch, you know?
Attempt to cover.
And that's what's great about her. She fucking doesn't care. She's going to do it. And she nailed it. She fucking hit notes on there that you can't believe, someone her age is being able to hit still. And so I thought the cover was great. I just played acoustic. I sang backgrounds. I did all the backgrounds. And then she called me up and said, will you come and be in the video? And I'm like, of course. You know, it's like Dolly Parton calls or asks for something. There's no hesitation. It's just yes.
Yeah. I mean, she's just, you know, you measure so much by her career and her success. Yeah. Just what an incredible individual.
But that was a fun, I mean, Cheap Trick, yes, but Dolly Parton, yes, as well. Like, they ride right there, because Dolly is one of the most, I mean, I've always been a fan of Dolly Parton, like since I was a little kid, you know, like when I could watch TV and see her and hear her music. And so that was a pretty awesome experience, because it's like, listen, man, you know, you said it too with The Who. It's like, you are growing up and you're seeing these people that are iconic legends, and you're watching them, you're listening to them, you're buying their records, you're a fan. And then a couple moves that you make in your life, and I'm like in the same room with Dolly Parton, you know what I mean? I'm like in the same room with Cheap Trick, and they're actually doing something with me. It's almost like we get connected to certain things, and then they come to life. They manifest into real things.
It's true. I mean, I got to tell you, that's for me, one of the things that's been just one of the most beautiful things and what I'm grateful for every day is, you know, these people that were heroes of mine as a child, as you know, that I loved, and musicians, and whether it be David Bowie, who I ended up having a great relationship with, to interviewing the Stones or McCartney. I mean, just, I for me, that's, those are just pinch me moments, and I'm just so grateful for them. And I still get excited and love it. I love it. And I love sitting here with you talking about our mutual passion for music and hearing your story. Like that's the thing I love the most, you know? And that's why I'm grateful. Like, you know, when we talk about this, what this podcast is about, it's like breaking through and, you know, getting through some those rough times. And, you know, I'm so grateful after having an aneurysm as a teenager and, you know, that trauma and being hit by a car and a lot of other things. I'm just grateful to be here. And I had to ask you, so you mentioned that your childhood part, there were rough parts of it. Was that one of the things also that music gave you relief from? Like, I mean, because for me, that was a big part of it.
Yeah. Like I said, when I heard Karen Carpenter's voice, it really made me understand what music is supposed to do. It's supposed to make you feel. And whether you feel like crying, dying, dancing, or running, it's meant to make you feel. And I guess I used that feeling that was, you know, not being good enough. All the shit, the trauma, the physical, mental, emotional trauma I experienced. Yeah, it's an outlet because I get to write songs that express my fucking feelings and they don't get stuck inside. Like, sure, there's shit stuck in there for sure. I'm dark and I got a lot of things I got to work out, but I'm also mainly a pretty stable person, really have a good head on my shoulders. And yeah, darkness is always going to be there, man. We're going to always struggle with that shit, but I embrace it. I'm like, okay, come on. I know how to work with it. I know how to use it to benefit me. And I think that's what it did. Music helped me get a hold of the monster and contain it and be able to just let it out. And yeah, there's some stuff. I'm gonna hold on to this because I like this. I'm not quite ready to let go of this little demon yet. You know, I'm gonna pop it under my hat and use it for a rainy day when I need it. You know, because I also am like I guess a lot of junkies, Kurt Cobain, let's just take him, felt like without heroin, he wasn't going to be a good writer. And I feel like sometimes without those little pieces of darkness living in me, I'm not going to be able to express myself as well. So there is a bit of that that you have to figure out because that's not healthy. You know, it's not healthy to want to keep shit in order for you to use it. Just get rid of all of it if you can. So, you know, those are the things that I'm working on. And so, yeah, I mean, listen, I'm working on myself every day. I notice things about me all the time. I'm a great mom. I'm not my mom. I'm a great mom, actually. And I love that. I'm a great mommy, you know, and I am a great friend. I feel like I'm a pretty good human being, and I feel like I'm intelligent. I have tons of common sense. I'm extremely talented. I'm really giving. I'm a philanthropist. I like to mentor. And so I'm doing good. So whatever shit I had, I figured it out and I got me into a place where I'm using it to help others and to benefit myself and to make sure that I am giving my son a life that is healthy and not filled with childhood fucking bullshit.
Yeah, that's great. I gotta say how much I love that. And I think what's really also really important is how you talked about, you know, you were able to put things down. You tried everything. You know, you did, but you, when you knew, were you like this? I mean, when you knew it was being a detriment? Because I always believed that, you know, that was the thing that was the worst for me. It was, you know, I love music so much. I love what I do. I love doing radio, or if it happens to be anything that has to do with music. You know, as you know, I did A&R. I did all these different things. Radio, television with MTV and a bunch of other things, and still do all of that pretty much. But it was getting in the way. It was causing the things that I loved the most and cared about the most. It was clouding my vision, and it was causing me to be, for me, it was causing me to be unreliable, and it was making me sick and slowly killing me. So I needed to change it. And I'm in a very good place now, you know, 3 years and 7 months since I've had a drink or anything, and I'm very grateful.
Congratulations.
Yeah. For you, Linda, was that one of the things too, where you were just like, you know, this is going to get in the way of what I really love and why? I mean, did it get to a point where you said this? I know you were able to stop, which is so great, when you're ready to, but you just say, hey, this smoking's not good for me. This, you know, drinking. What was that?
Yeah, I had a couple bad moments. One was with Courtney. That's super funny, but scary at the same time. A couple when I was younger, but it's like I said, it can't be an option. If sugar is making me crazy or having an effect on me, I stop eating sugar. So it's like, that's the kind of personality I have. And again, like I said, not everybody has that, but I never thought alcohol, drugs, that was what wasn't going to get me. It was me. So I said to myself, I need to change, because it could be this, it could be that. It's all going into the same person. So I can stop this, but I'm still going to have this. So I had to make a life change. And the life change was just going, none of this is acceptable for me. This is not a choice. Drinking coffee for me is not an option. You know, eating meat is not an option. Shooting up drugs or smoking is not an option. Drinking alcohol, not an option. It's just not an option. So therefore, it's not on my menu. It's not on my radar. It's not even in anything. But you know what? I could cook you a steak, feed you beer, give you beer, and everybody can be shooting up all around me, and I'd be fine. You know what I mean? I'm that type of person where just because I'm making life changes doesn't mean, because that's where I think rehab goes wrong. Rehab tries to convince people that they have to change their friends and all this. It's not realistic. They have to leave rehab and go into a world that have all this going on. You can't avoid it. You know, I mean, honestly, Matt, I've had some of the most incredible experiences. I'm so grateful. I've had a great career because I'm humble. I'm a humble person. You know, you can call me whatever you want and tell me I'm a legend, I'm in the Hall of Fame, whatever. It doesn't matter. I just love making music with people who love making music. And so it's just, I just have a wonderful life. So that is success to me. Success is, am I happy doing what I'm doing? Yes, I'm super fucking happy and super grateful.
That's great. Well, Linda, I want to say thank you so much. This was amazing. It was so great to have you here. I love catching up with you. We've always had great conversations. It's been
anytime. Call me anytime.
Thank you so much, Linda. Well, it was so great to have Linda Perry here on the podcast. I mean, I love her honesty, her passion. She's such an incredible talent and really a great person. And I love people that are really upfront and straight and tell you exactly how they feel. And that's what we hope that you get out of our podcast. Thank you so much for listening to Sound Sobriety and Success. I'm your host, Matt Pinfield. If you like this, please hit like, subscribe, and tell other people about it. And if you know somebody that needs to hear the messages, and everybody's got a little bit of a different opinion, but that's the beauty of it, because there's no one way to get and stay sober and clean. There are many ways. You might hear something in this podcast, and so may a friend, that really strikes a nerve and a chord. And that's why we're doing this, because we want to be of service. So thank you so much for listening. I'll be back with you soon.
If you or someone you know is struggling with alcoholism or addiction, Music Cares operates a mental health and addiction recovery program that understands the challenges music professionals face, no matter where they are in their career. Learn more, including if you're eligible, at musiccares.org. That's musiccares.org.
Sound, sobriety, and success with Matt Pinfield. Produced by Jake Urbanek. Engineered by Darren Silva. Terrion Zeldo, booking and research. Susan Axu Magarian and Robbie Gissell, marketing. Sound, sobriety, and success is a Bennstown McVeigh podcast production.